Japantown, located in the heart of downtown San Jose, has been a vital part of Santa Clara Valley's history since the 1890s. The first wave of Japanese immigrants were attracted to the area for job opportunities in the burgeoning agriculture industry. Insular Japantown neighborhood provided the Japanese with a safe harbor place to shop and socialize. But within months of the onset of World War II, Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066 forced all Japanese to pack their bags and relocate to internment camps far from the Pacific coast. Japantown resident Jimmy Yamaichi was 19 years old when he and his family were ordered to report to the San Jose State University Gymnasium, where they were subsequently ordered to board a train for Southern California, where they and the rest of their fellow Japantown community residents were processed and sent to various internment camps, such as Manzanar, Tule Lake, and Heart Mountain. Jimmy and his family were eventually imprisoned at Tule Lake for the duration of the war. When Jimmy returned to San Jose in 1946, a brutal struggle to secure a union carpenter's card ensued, but he eventually went to work in the building trades as the very first Japanese carpenter ever accepted by the local union hiring hall. 15 years after World War II, Jimmy was still confronting racism against Japanese. In 1960, when he tried to purchase a home in San Jose, his offer was flatly refused solely because he was of Japanese ancestry. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me at the Japanese American Museum in San Jose's Japantown for a visit with 93-year-old Jimmy Yamaichi as he recalls his life journey and, most poignantly, his repeated encounters with endemic racism and his internment at Tule Lake from May of 1942 until May of 1946, and most touchingly, his sense of humor that has never diminished. Jimmy Yamaichi.
What a pleasure. What is the name of this building? This is a museum of sorts.
This is a museum, the Japanese American Museum of San Jose. And it's been founded about 25 years ago, 1987. We started the organization. And we're fortunate to have this building here today. One of our members was able to buy the residence. This was a doctor's residence with offices in the front, with a living quarters in the back, like, you know, the old story.
Sure.
And we just kind of outgrew it. The house is a house. You got hallways and bathrooms, kitchen. And so I decided, well, we had a chance to get a matching fund with the state of California and the Cultural History Improvement Program. But that funding, matching fund, we were able to build this building. We're fortunate that people kicked in, and within a year's time, we owned the whole place.
Very cool. This has been a really surprisingly pleasant day for me. I did not know that there was a Japantown in San Jose that's very historic and goes way back. Everybody has heard of Chinatown in San Francisco, but here is a whole neighborhood. If you cut out the surrounding area, it would be its own town. It has a main street and downtown shops, and it's all Japanese motif, right?
Yeah. Well, the beauty part of it, like you say, majority, well, there's about 17 buildings that still stand today is the original Japantown building. And we're the only one situated in the same location from day one.
And the first Japanese emigrated to San Jose how long ago?
It was about 1885 is the first one that came from Japan. And then
and were they primarily agricultural workers? Is that what attracted them?
Yes, it was. Basically, the big portion of them came turn of the century, 1800 to 1900. And what happened, because Santa Clara Valley was starting growing as an orchard, and the Chinese, there used to be a Chinatown here, and that's how Japantown, that should be a familiar background and the food and so forth. So they, across the street, that's how Japantown started.
So it was right next to Chinatown?
Yeah, so they were very compatible. We had no problem. But like you know, the Chinese were not allowed to bring the wives here. So this AG block company, a dry food company that was in Santa Clara, needed help to process the food and so forth, pick it. in the late 1800, 1889, as you probably know, Hawaii was annexed to the United States as a territory. So there was quite a few Japanese immigrants in Hawaii. They were not getting paid very much.
Cane workers, probably.
Yeah, cane workers, and it was very, very poor. Mm-hmm. Hard work. And they went over to Hawaii and asked, hey, we'll pay you more money. You want to come to California? Well, they had a passport, right? Because it's the territory of America. So they got on the ship and came across here. Meantime, fruit farming, you just got only a season only. Mm-hmm. They pick the crop, wait for it to trim the trees and so forth, you know, maintain the orchard. And so the landlord says, I want you guys to go out there in the backyard, raise enough vegetables that you can survive through the winter. And which they did. You know, they almost came from the farming in the family background, so it came out pretty good. You know, after all, it was a prime land. It was not the poor soil, good mm-hmm. soil. And so following it, they plant more. Hey, this is pretty good stuff here. So they start selling to the friends. And so about the third year, it says, hey, I don't think we can work for the company here. Let's start our own farming. Mm-hmm. And that's how the farming got started.
So the Japanese farming enterprise was huge and strong here, right?
Strong, very strong, because of the fact that discrimination was very, very high, right? But the thing is, when the Chinese were petering out, you know, that they were only coolies, right? Mm-hmm. No family. And they're coming over late 1800 was shut off. The water was cut off, like, and they're looking for more help from the Asian people. And Japan was the next country. Mm. So if you know the Japanese history, in the early 1900, Japan was a strong navy. And they
beat the Russians.
Yeah, they lost the bay. Mm-hmm. So America had something to contend. So Japan says, if you can take our men folks, it's only human that you take women folks. Mm-hmm. They're family people.
Yep.
And they kind of split around, but they said, okay. After all, you know, like today, it is the army power, right? I mean, military power. And they were just a small country, but they had a little more sense how to fight the Russians. And with that in mind, so they said, okay, we'll let you come in here until 1924, right, as you probably know. Meantime, they all came over, and they couldn't get over the fast enough, bring the wives over. And so the picture bride, you probably heard mm-hmm. the story of how the picture bride.
So picture brides were popular here in Japantown, in San Jose?
Oh, yeah, but quite a few, because mm-hmm. a lot of them couldn't get back there in time. Mm-hmm. And they were making any penis, you know, yourself,
sure.
to go over there, to get on the ship and take time out and look for wives, come back. Mm-hmm. And so the proxy marriage type of deal. And they said, well, yes, they verify, yep, he's married, so as long as he got a piece of paper, they went to Angel Island, they processed him through, and the poor Chinese were stuck in Angel Island, and says, how come those people, they look like us, and they come in on the ferry boat, and they process them through, then go back out again, says, hey, how come they can get do that? But the Chinese had tough because the Chinese government at the time was very, very weak. They had no power whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So they were stuck for a long, long time.
Interesting. Yet the Japanese could sail through Angel Island real quick then.
Yeah, that's what it was. Mm-hmm. Meantime, the Japanese didn't make too much noise about this and that. Sure, they were discriminated from this and discriminated that. And I was just reading a book about how they discriminated even farming. And they had a unique way of doing things because the old folks that did come, the American citizens, so U.S. put a stop to it because if you're not a white U.S. citizen, mm-hmm. a white immigrant, you cannot be a naturalized citizen, right? How could we circumvent that? So they figured a way out. So especially in Santa Clara Valley, the youngsters were born, but they were not 21. They couldn't own the land. And because they had a trial case in Fresno where the son was born and he bought the land on the son's name. And then the local people said, hey, this baby, he didn't earn the money to buy the land, so you know, it's illegal. So they took him to court and said, yeah, the court said it was illegal to put under the child's name. And so they lost. So knowing that situation, So they work a deal out. They got a piece of farm, and the landlord will fix, put the roads in, bring electricity, bring water pumps, this and that. And they prorate it every year and take it out of the expense. And then actually take care of the rental. And that all be prorated. And at the bottom line, they took royalty by using your name. So there it is. So they got by with that. And finally somebody got wise to it, took them to court. But they fought that. You know how it is. You always can go around the deal there. And I know my dad, he was farming like that for 10 years. And for 1920, about 21 or 20, about 1920, I guess. He got married 1917. He farmed someplace else at 20, ended up in Berryessa, and made a deal with a guy named Charles Brandt. And 10 years he farmed there, he figured out a lot. The royalty, so-called the royalty, using the name Charles Brandt, it cost him in 10 years over $20,000.
Wow, in those dollars.
So he says, if that's the case, I can own the land. If I lose it, I don't want to lose it either, right? Mm-hmm. Right now, I'm just giving the money away, right? Mm-hmm. So he bought the land in 1930, and my brother was not of age. And so what he did, he borrowed a guy named Fred Inouye's name. So everything was Fred Inouye by Yamaichi. So Yamaichi was the manager of the Inouye company.
Oh, interesting.
Like any other, they can always get us. And then in 1939, when my brother turned 21, they just transferred to my brother's name.
Well, tell us about what drove the Japanese economy here in San Jose, in Japantown area, from like 1900 until 1940. That was agriculture. It was pretty much everything, wasn't it?
That's right.
So almost everybody worked at some level, either selling or producing.
Mostly producing, because of the fact that when we registered to go to camp, they actually, according to the census, there were approximately 4,000. And out of 4,000, they were doing 65% of the vegetable business was done by that 4,000.
Wow.
You figure that's men, women, and children, right?
Yeah.
So you figure only 50% is productive. So only about 2,000 people were producing 65%. And then actually there was other nationality growers. But Italian were the next biggest farmer, vegetable farmers. And they will put a one-time crop, like I say, like carrots, you pull it out, you're done, right? Turnips, you're done. Where we were raising tomatoes, cucumbers, fruit crop where it takes time and labor. And actually, per acre, you make a lot more money.
And by that time, mid-20s and 30s, you had second, third generation. Nisei?
Yeah, Niseis were coming in to be strong. So the people were buying land under the Nisei's name or renting or land deals, some shape or form. And when the war broke out, according to the research I've done, that the landlord, a fellow named Ben Peckham, everybody transferred everything to Ben Peckham. He was the biggest landowner in the Santa Clara Valley. Because
all the Japanese turned
it over to him. And then says, you take care of it? Sure, he took it to a bank account, paying the taxes, and so forth. And a lot of them did come back and got, because
there's some ugly other stories California where their land and houses were basically just stolen and
completely
taken.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, let's back up in time to the 20s and 30s. And on the California Central Coast, some of the people that I know, Japanese, who are older and lived through that period of time, said that many of the Japanese, it was said they were more American than the Americans in some ways.
Yeah.
That for many of the Japanese, they very much wanted to be a part of the American fabric. Boy Scout troops, Girl Scout troops, baseball teams, and so very much proud of being American. True?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it proved it because with that, the war ended in 1940, World War II. The Navy came out with a statement that says there was not one sabotage spying done by Japanese that proves that there wasn't no spies.
Right.
In the beginning, they said, well, there were spies, it's dangerous to the economy, this and that, so they got to haul them back. And so.
Jimmy, how old are you?
I'm 93.
93. So you were here when the internment order came in San Jose?
Yes, I was 19. The average age of Niseis were 19.
Okay, so you well vividly remember that.
Oh, very much so. Yes, I've gone through high discrimination. Because just the fact, like my personal background is, I want to be a carpenter. And I saw my dad hired a carpenter to build his house when he bought the house in the early 1930. And so I went to trade school and graduated. I was one of the top classes. But I went down Union Hall because the Union was strong. As you probably know, this area here is strong way back then. I just said, we don't allow Japs here. You know, that was it.
What year was that?
1941.
Okay, and that was before Pearl Harbor.
Before Pearl Harbor.
World War II. Wow.
June of 1941, I graduated. Mm-hmm. And all my buddy that was in my class, non-Japanese, they got the card, went to work, and drove. Good wages were, I was drawing peanuts. My dad said, well, you can make more money on the farm than pounding nail for a non-union guy. So that's how it was, you know.
So were you interned?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I spent 4 years.
Can you tell us about that time, that day, when the United States Army came and got you? What were you doing? What did you think?
Well, like my dad, his education was very limited. He didn't, most of them were. And we used to discuss the issue on the dinner table. And because the first thing, 1939 and 40, they were putting embargo on Japan, oil and gas, and then gradually the iron ore and copper. You have to read, you probably know American history, that at the time of the war, World War II, America was the depower as far as raw material. They were shipping oil out here, but tons of iron ore.
Right, and Japanese being an island, limited.
Non-productive, non-producing island. Yeah. And so they had to buy everything. And eventually, by 1940, 41, they start cutting this out,
the
cutting
embargo, that out. Yeah.
And I met a guy that was in camp with me, and he was shipping copper to Japan. And originally was shipping copper ore. Then they put embargo, said, well, get whatever you can. So all junk copper, like radiators and copper, tube, whatever, maybe he scrapped it up and sent to Japan. And so that was part of one of the, I think, Japan said, well, do or die type of deal.
Right.
So they went to war. And you understand that part. So we said, well, finally they just got at the point where they, well, if we don't go after it, we're not going to get it.
Right.
So, we knew that they could never make it. You know, they figured Japan is only as big as California's total land, square miles-wise, you know, and trying to fight a country like the United States, like California, trying to fight the whole United States, you could never do it.
Right.
Whatever we got. You know. But anyway, so when the order did come, we said, well, I guess that's it. But now, you look at San Jose, like other areas there, Naval Intelligence Service from 1930 was already tracking the Japanese American. Like today, the Muslim people being tracked and watched, FBI's watched, so forth. FBI came in the picture later. And so they knew exactly where we were going. If you go to Japan, where you visit, did anybody come from here? So forth. I mean, they knew every time we turned around. First go around, when the war broke out, in the first couple of days, they picked up 2,000 Japanese Iseis, the first generation.
In San Jose or in Santa Clara Valley?
No, West Coast.
West Coast, okay.
Yeah, West Coast and Hawaii.
Because they thought the Isei would be the biggest risk.
Risk, yeah. Well, they presumed they'd be anti-American, pro-Japan, and which was not true. But the thing is, now, you yourself, they knew way back 1930, they were already tracking stuff. For 10 years, they were tracking. So when the war broke out, in 2 days' time, to go after one person, FBI had to have two person to pick up one person.
Wow.
That's usually the order. Wow. You can have a backup. They were afraid of themselves, right? You walk into a Japanese family, they might get a sword stuck in the back or something like that.
Because they just didn't know.
They didn't know. Mm-hmm. So you pick up 2,000, I mean, they had to mobilize 4,000 men to pick up 2,000.
And this was just days after the start of the war.
The first Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And now you had 2,000 men that had a place to stay, right? They were all ready. Missoula, Montana was all prepped for them.
Wow.
So Missoula, Montana was only going to carry 1,200 men. So the balance was shipped to North Dakota, Bismarck. They call it Bismarck Camp. As you probably heard it many, many times. Fort Lincoln.
Yeah. I've been to Manzanar,
Yeah.
So you were 19 years old. You were in Issei.
Yeah.
And you know and you heard right away what was happening to the Issei.
Yeah.
What did you think? Did you thought, well, I'll be okay or they will not come? And
well, when the war broke out, naturally, where majority of us were farming. Now, they want us out of California, regardless, before the war, way before the war. In the mid-30s, they tried different way of doing it. The five major organizations was the Produce Association, the Sons and Daughters of the Golden West, the American Legion, the Farm Bureau, and the five major went to Washington. And they had enough pull in Washington because when Roosevelt made his first commitments, his we will take care of all American citizens and treat them as an American citizen. But when they came with the pressure of the lobbyists in February, I have a letter written by one of his secretaries of the cabinet, his cabinet, wrote and says, to the president, there's no need to evacuate them. They're safe, they're good, and they're no problem.
So they were supporting you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, they were supporting it.
And this is February of 1942.
But that was on 17th, on 18th, 19th, I forgot. In fact, the executive order was signed against, because about 10 days earlier, Roosevelt says, we will make sure all American citizens be treated like American citizens. But we were American citizens, but we're all, as long as you have 1/16 Japanese blood, you're going to go to camp, regardless where you are.
So how did they find you? Did you just have to turn yourself in and...
Oh, yeah. Well, this is, how far could I go
with
my face,
right?
I mean, if I walk alongside, the first thing they can point at, hey, who's a Jap, right?
How did you wind up turning yourself in? Where, did they tell you to report to a building?
Oh, yeah, that's an executive order came out there saying that we had to report May the 23rd at San Jose State Men's Gymnasium. And that's what we reported.
And you knew to bring a suitcase and what you needed?
Well, yeah, no, they said, 23rd, on the 30th, be ready to leave.
But you knew you were going away. You
yeah,
knew.
Oh, yeah. We don't know where we were going. Because camps that was inland, they were building those 10 camps. Nobody knew about it. It was kind of hush-hush, too.
So you just knew you were going somewhere.
Somewhere, yeah. So we didn't know what kind of...
Were you scared at all?
Well, to a point, yes. But then again, you know, you've been ostracized, kicked around, you know, because you're a Jap. A Jap is a Jap regardless. This is the same old crap they give you. You go to the store, you don't wait on you.
Wow.
The Western, they kick your ass out. You know, different thing like that.
You were used to that.
Yeah, we're used to that. So, you know, another one of those things there, they're going to put pressure on us. So we had to probably move on type of deal. And we couldn't get an answer. Now, you figure, executive order was signed February 19th. On the 20th of March, the first group of 10,000 in Manzanar was drugged in, right? So that's how fast they moved.
Wow.
I mean, you build a town in 30 days, that's a hard... Sure, the place is not quite ready. And the people that went to the camp early, they helped build the barracks, built their own jail for them, for the day.
Right. So when you left San Jose State Gymnasium, did you go on a Greyhound bus, or was it...
No,
Army truck? Or?
No, we had to make our own transportation to the railroad station. We registered on the 23rd. On the 30th, we're told we had to report at a given station.
In San Jose?
San Jose. And it was not the station. We were on the siding because they don't want to see the Japs get on at the station. They were rough gravelies, no place where we just was
in the dirt.
In the dirt, yes. So that's how we took off and went to a so-called assembly center, temporary holding area, and approximately 84,000 was hauled in that manner. So the rest of it was in another 4 or 5 months. Was all because by end of August or early September, everybody was behind barbed wire fence. So 120,000 of us.
Wow. And what camp did you go to?
Well, my first assembly center, temporary quarters, was Pomona. That was Los Angeles County Fairgrounds. Then from there went on to Heart Mountain, Wyoming. And my dad wanted to go to the Tule Lake. And why one?
Could he have a choice of what camp he went to?
No.
But so he's just hoping.
Yeah. But my dad wanted to go to Tule Lake. He really didn't tell us what, because we're told you don't argue against your seniors. I mean, he says jump, you just jump. That's it. You know, so we were brought up with that type of a background. So we never argued that why we were going to Tule Lake, but he wanted to go. So we end up in Tule Lake. I spent 3.5 years there in Tule Lake.
So the whole war?
Through the whole war, when the war ended, yes.
And while you were there, did you get madder and madder? Were you resentful? What were you thinking? How did you stay centered?
Well, summer of 41, my brother, the three of us, was of age to be drafted. See, the three of us were 18, you know, I was 18, my brother. And the draft board says, one of the three got to go. So my second brother, he said he'll go. So he went. In the meantime, war broke out, and they were treated pretty roughly. Even soldiers like him, he were at San Luis Obispo, Camp Roberts.
Okay, yeah.
He was training there because the war wasn't started. The war started, and actually still was there. And they shipped him to Fort Riley, Kansas. And that's when they stripped him of his arms and took all his guns away and then gave him a wooden gun.
Wow, in the Army.
In the Army.
Wow.
So, you know, in the meantime, Roosevelt came visiting the Fort Riley, Kansas. There, all the time he was there, all the Japanese American soldiers were rounded up with machine gun pointing right at them, says, any of you guys even dare to move, we'll kill you. So there you are, a fellow that you sleep alongside of you, he's got a gun against you, and we're all wearing the same uniform.
Right.
And you know, things like that. For my brother and how they were treated.
Mm-hmm. Did he ever go to Europe or go?
He went to Europe.
Were things better for him there, I presume?
Well, he went to Europe, fought in the European theater.
In Italy?
Italy and France, yeah. And he came out of it pretty good, just a little scratch. But in the meantime, when I was in Tule Lake camp, at the time, we get back there, the sign says, you know, all alien and non-aliens shall go to camp, but shall report. Well, who's non-alien? You and I, we're non-alien. So that's the time we lost our citizenship rights as an American citizen. Because when I turned 21, I went to administration and said, I always look forward to the day I vote. Because at grade school, our civic teacher said, well, when you're 21, you come here and vote like an American. And they use a grade school for a polling place. So I went to, I know, I get my butt kicked, and they laughed at me. Said, what the heck do you want? Citizenship, you know, to vote. I said, well, maybe I thought. But anyway, I was in camp. We had, 28 guard towers around us. We had 1,200 soldiers watching us in Tule Lake. And I got a draft call to be drafted into the Army.
And this was 44?
44, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I was one of those 27 from Tule Lake resisted.
And, oh, really?
Yeah.
So, I read about that.
Yeah.
And what led you to resist? What
And then I can't vote no more. I'm not an American citizen. And you find out that we lost our citizenship anyway because the executive order said non-aliens, regardless, 116th Japanese blood, you go to camp, regardless, diapers or no diapers, right? Thing like that.
when you were involved in the act of protest and resistance and saying, no, we're not going, what did they do to you?
Eventually we went to court, and there's all the other camps that are fighting the issue, too. Then again, we went from Tulare, went to Eureka. That was the summer court. The federal judge will go up there like a glorified vacation. But he had to hit the gavel, like the Indians, they were drinking, or somewhere were fishing off for them. It's just anything, just to, you know, scratch a piece of paper, that's about all. So this Judge Goodman from San Francisco went up there for his annual federal judge's so-called shindig. And a guy named Hill, attorney, he had all written out affidavit that all 27 of us will be ready to go to be sentenced to jail. And the judge, wait a minute, I said, I came up here to just to be here. Then here, I get, there's 27 guys are draft evaders, and so they're going to put them in jail. And meantime, he didn't know exactly what the case meant, what it was all about, and he dug in deeper and deeper and deeper. And if he signed that order, without a trial, we were ready to go right to McNeil Island. That was the whole thing.
Okay.
And which he didn't think was right. This is, so meantime, he asked the attorney that I'm going to bring my own attorney in, a guy named McGowan. And it was a feisty old guy that was went to school with Goodman. And finally, they went to look the law. The law says, only free Americans shall be drafted into the U.S. Army. He says, you're not a free American. I said, no, we got 28 guard towers and 1,200 soldiers around us. We can't leave the camp without escort and so forth. So you're not a free American, no? Okay, he's on ready. You can go back to Tule Lake again. But the rest of the guys were all sent to federal penitentiary and served 3 years in pen.
Really?
Some of them got hard labor. They went to Arizona, made roads and this and that. The majority went to McNeil Island and served 3 years in jail. And it was...
For protesting and resisting.
From the draft evasion.
But you did not, because of your attorney.
Yeah, no, my judge.
Oh, your judge.
Judge says it was not right the way they were doing things. Mm-hmm.
But the other guys had a different judge then?
Oh, yeah, they were different court. They had Rocky Mountain State, Midwest States, you know, Southern States, Southwest, had different...
Jurisdiction.
Court. So it was each one how they felt. And so I was one part of the draft of resistors, and we used to get together every year, once a year at least. And I tell you, you guys are all bad guys. I'm the good guy.
We kid each other.
Yeah, no, yeah. It's awful fun. But But then again, now, you have to understand, President Truman, we saw the fallacy of the law, of the judge ruling. Now, all these guys here, they fought the issue as an American citizen, and they lost because the draft resistors did not have a full right, full attorney to support them. Attorney says, it's your case, you go and talk to the judge. Well, you get 18-year-old kids talk to a judge that's been on the bench for 50-some-odd years. Mm-hmm. You know, in the meantime, the judge just threw the book at them. But then again, Truman saw that the judges broke the law. Because the law, the Selective Service Act says, only free Americans shall be. And they were not free like us in Tule Lake. They had wire fence around them, guards and army at the gate and so forth. So Truman pardoned all of them. Otherwise, I'm sure the United States could have been sued to the hilt because they're the one that broke the law, not the draft
register.
They were fighting for the rights as an American citizen.
So there was vindication then.
Yeah, so all of them were given full pardon and restored their citizenship fully and so forth. But then again, the damage was done. When they returned, they were
bitter.
Oh, the community just crucified them.
Really?
Oh, really, really. And some of them were so afraid to even talk to them. They got married and so forth. The kids knew about it. Some of them took it with them to the grave.
Didn't say anything.
You said draft resistant? Mm-hmm. Oh, you don't belong here. Yeah. Just like us, when the two, like, first thing you said, oh, a bunch of bad guys. To each his own. I mean, each one, sure, it's all sound, but everybody's there for a reason. Yeah. And then they had their gripes about the whole situation, and they went to Tule Lake.
Mm-hmm. So that took guts on your part
to
stand up. You knew that it'd be easier to keep your mouth shut.
That's right, yeah. You couldn't talk to nobody. Mm-hmm. You know, you couldn't discuss the issue because Tule Lake was a kind of rough camp too, you know. Mm-hmm. So we had to kind of watch for ourselves, or else you could put yourself in a bad situation. But then again...
So for you, it was total principle.
It's a total principle that I shouldn't go, you know. I think I was right. If my brother had been treated that way, when the president comes around, they, with your buddy, with rifle, with machine gun, puts in there, haul him into the warehouse, mm-hmm. had him...
Held him prisoner.
Held him prisoner until he left, you know.
Wow.
So things like that. And then, meantime, there's a lot of Japanese-American soldiers that was in the Army early 19, late 40, 41. This is DB boys, they call them. Hmm. Disciplinary barracks. And they were already in the Army, okay. And fighting alongside, training and all this and that.
Yeah.
And a lot of them was up to a lieutenant, this and that. And they said, well, we want you guys to go to Fort Shelby and join the 442, all Japanese American. I said, we're happy here. We got a company here. We're going to stay here. Mm-hmm. And all my buddies are here. Why do we have to go? So you got to go. And they fought the issue, and they stripped up their ranks completely down to buck private.
Wow.
And they called them the DB boys. 1800 Engineering Battalion. Real fancy name. Mm-hmm. They repaired roads and this and that. And they did a lot of ugly part of the jobs there. Mm-hmm. And some of them put this so hard that they went to Leavenworth.
That's really interesting because you don't hear about that. What you hear about is that any and all Japanese who signed up for the 442nd all did it voluntarily.
Yeah.
All did it on their own. So you're saying that there were some Japanese who were basically at gunpoint to a sense.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was a real harsh because of the family, and this is a lot of disgrace to the family.
So one day you're at Tule Lake and the word comes down. How did you hear that the war ended, and then what happened to you?
Well, I think the war, we knew that it was getting pretty close, you know. In the meantime, the pro-Japanese people that was in Tule Lake, they said, well, our shortwave radio set said Japan's winning the war. How could it be? You read the American paper, they took this out and took that out, right? They're getting pretty close, right? They're beating them in the back door. And they said, no, there's no chance. Anyway, I said, well, I'm pretty sure they're glad when the atomic bomb. I said, you know, like today, they say this and that about Japan. I'm not for Japan, but like President Truman, one man's power, he dropped two bombs, right? Mm-hmm. Hiroshima and Nagasaki killed 100,000 people. And then, I don't know if you follow the paper very much, now they haven't said too much about, but the comfort woman in Korea.
Sure, I know about that.
Yeah, you probably hear about that. It's sure, the American Army must have had the same thing because America won the war. Mm-hmm. They can cover that up. But Truman dropped the bomb. Women and children, regardless, they decimated them completely, 100%. But that, what's wrong with that? Oh, no, this and that. No. Oh, well, okay. It's okay to a point. But I think I always, you know, I speak a lot on a different level. Mm-hmm. I always say we always learn to live with other people and learn their customs and so forth. We all have a peculiar customs. They wear the funny little clothes. Well, we don't wear it, but we do certain things, you know, eat certain things. Sure, we have our funny things that we do, each nationality.
Mm-hmm. Everyone.
Yeah, everyone. It's, you just learn to live with it, that darn thing. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, like I always say, it's just live every day and live every day to the fullest, you know.
Okay, so back to Tule Lake. How did you hear that the war ended? And how soon were you able to leave, and how did you leave and get home?
Well, now there's another big story. According to my record, I was sent to Washington to get my personal record. I got and I was already in August of 1945. I had my release all signed, and they didn't release me till February 16th of 46.
So you stayed at Tule Lake that time?
Yeah. But meantime, they wanted somebody to stay behind and do the closing of the camps. And so I volunteered. Well,
Did you get paid?
I got paid a few. Okay. Not much, but I stayed behind, and they closed the gate. So I was in camp for four solid years, from May 30th, 1942 to May 30th, 1946.
Wow.
I came home in 46.
So when you came home, how did you get back to San Jose, and where did you stay when you got home?
Well, my dad and my brother that was in the Army, he got released early from the European War. And actually, we left one car in a barn, and the person belonging in one room. And the people that took care of our place, he says, we'll make sure they don't touch that room. Yeah, everything else loose they took, but the car was still there. Mm-hmm. And so they came down there, and we had an old, just a little house. And the people who rented the house converted that to a chicken coop.
Wow.
So my father and my brother had to spend 3 days cleaning the chicken coop out because they couldn't get in the regular house because they had the contract on the lease. Mm-hmm. Saying that and the war ends, they can leave until then they could stay there. So, mm-hmm. So they had to stay six months. They stay in chicken coop.
Wow.
The beauty part of it, I got married in 49, and that was our honeymoon cottage with that chicken coop.
So obviously it was fixed up. Yeah. And so you were fortunate, though, in that the family, you did not lose your house.
Yes, and like I said earlier, the union didn't allow me in the carpenter.
Right.
Well, being 4 years older, you know, 4 years more, nothing. Mm-hmm. I'm going to beat these guys. So I went down to Union Hall, and the same business agent that was there when I went to camp was still there, Jergy and Swain. Jergy is the one with the dirty mouth, you son of a bitch and jab and so forth. Okay, so what, you know. And Swain was nice. And so when I came back, I went up. There's an old Victorian house, a flight of steps, and they looked at me, you son of a bitch, and Jeff, get your ass out of here.
My God.
I said, okay. But then again, I said, well, being older, I'm going to be persistent like the Army. They're going to get you. So every other week, I will go up there, and you just give me a ball. I mean, every time I go up the steps, getting steeper and steeper, you know, you get your butt kicked and everything, get out of there. You know. So finally, mid-August, they said, okay, Jim, you get a job at the union shop, we'll give you a card. The deal, we'll shake on it. Jerky said, we'll shake on it. So I got on my car, moved down the street, and it's after the war in 46, there was not much going on, and there were a few construction work, about a hospital there, and this there. And there was a drive-in restaurant being built. Hey, there's a job there about my speed, and I knew the company. E.A. Hathaway, he was a union shop, I know from before I went to camp. So I asked the guy, he says, how about a job? He says, sure. He says, you got your tools? I says, yep. Come on, get your tools, you'll put you to it right now. And sure enough, the business agent followed me. And said, actually, their voice is not that pleasant. They say, you son of a bitch, you know. Like, they said, you got a job, didn't you? I says, yeah. A deal's a deal. We'll give you a card. So I was able to break into the union. I was the first agent to break into the carpenters union in San Jose.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know.
So would that stay your career for most of the time?
Yeah, all over the years. Mm-hmm. Since 1942,
wow.
I've been in construction. Still, this is my project here. I'm still a curator, builder.
So you were doing the remodeling then? Yeah,
just a brand new building with an outside contract, but as far as the walls and this and that.
Back in the corner there, I see the tar paper, board and batten. Is that to replicate one of the barracks?
Barracks, that's right.
I thought so, yeah.
Outside,
yes.
The inside is a replica of Tule Lake. five-person barrack there. Mm-hmm. That's what that is.
And there's curtains to separate.
Yeah. Sheets. Some of them use blankets. And then, too, the clothes been hanging there. Mm-hmm. The outside be so dusty because it was out of nowhere. And when you want to take the sagebrush, the dust. It's just horrible. So we used to bring the clothes, wash, and then hang them inside the barrack. If you leave them outside, you had to wash them all over again. So, it was the same all over, all the different...
Well, Jimmy, I have to come back. I could literally spend days with you. This has been so wonderful.
What kind of story?
Tell us really briefly what somebody would see here at the museum.
Well, this is the old San Jose when folks came here, turn of the century, early, late 1800s. And then around the other side, going to camp, the camp story. And then this is we have a little section here, resettlement, coming back from camp. Mm-hmm. And then the Army, the 442 MIS. And then this is the general public traveling exhibit over there. Mm-hmm. And then back in two coins, there's all the farm equipment was used by Japanese Americans from day one, from 1900. We have over 100 years old machinery sitting back there.
Again, only because of time, we need to jump to Japantown itself and the downtown in this community. Post-World War II, how long did it take until you kind of moved on and the community itself, it's just looking forward rather than back?
Well, naturally, they didn't receive us. San Jose was a better town, let's face it. Like Salinas, this is, don't come back.
Wow.
That was it.
It's really?
You own the land, you can farm it, we can't do anything about that, but you don't live here. You go
this
back
to... This is post-World War II.
Yeah.
Wow.
You go back to Gilroy or... most of them came to San Jose. Mm-hmm. Then they would drive. But
in San Jose, you did not have that negative.
Well, I won't say that. We had to work for it. We really worked for it. Mm-hmm. And it was until about 1960, 15 years after the war ended, that we were able to go out because I myself fought the issue. I was married and the kids, I had to go to a set school. We're moving around. So we had a small little house. I don't know if you know this area here, Cambrian area, Cambrian Park area, they call it. It's a small three-bedroom house. And I told my realtor friend, says, you think I can buy the house? Well, we'll try and see. So he went over there and he says, Jim, no, they won't sell it to you.
Wow.
There were no Japs allowed.
And what year was this?
1960.
Wow.
So I said, well, let's try again. Let's try something. Let's take a vote in the community, that immediate area. Mm-hmm. So all around the front of the house, side of the house, back of the house, all the different family, and by vote of 6 to 7, I was able to move in.
Okay.
But one vote.
Wow.
So that's how it was. It was pretty new. And there's a little story about a returning veteran, Sam Yoshihara. He was moving by the county hospital, which is not the average place. And the neighbors just raised holy hell, said, we don't want no Japs. And they picketed the house. And he made a big deal about being a veteran. Here, so I fought the war, and they won't let me move in where I want.
And what year was this picketing?
1960. Right. After that, things got a little better. It took us 15 years to tell the public that. And then all these lots were, a lot of them were empty. Mm-hmm. They bought them all up and built homes because they had no place else to go. So 19th Street, 19 Taylor, there was a farm. The guy said, oh, hey, I'll build you a house. And then they went to get City Hall to get a permit. And the group of people said, they're going to build a Jap ghetto out there. So don't give them the permit. Even at that time.
Wow, that's the 60s.
The 60s. Wow. Now it took, meantime, our younger brother and sister went to school. I'm going to be school teachers, superintendent, principals. Mm-hmm. They were getting up and getting jobs. Lockheed was one of the biggest employers of Japanese Americans out of San Jose State. And to prove herself. And then that's like Norm Mineta got to be mayor of San Jose. We're only 2% of the population, mind you. 2%, we couldn't put him in office, right? It's got to be 70%, right? So they learned, because then our little brothers start working in a different field, right? Mm-hmm. Work with them, and what's wrong with them? We're just like everybody else, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think it took that long.
Yeah.
Because.
But you feel good now. I mean, things.
Yeah, well, it's still their discrimination. I mean, but the hell, we. And I'm going to point it out, hey, they do this and that, but you just kind of lay back. There's a little thing that always catches your eye, you know. Like you go to a restaurant there, everybody, as soon as you sit down, they give you a cup of water, nothing to forget you. You know, they purposely forget you to bring water to you. Yes, can we have water? Oh, okay, we'll bring you water. You know, this little thing like that. Mm-hmm. But you get caught up with it.
Yeah, but you notice that.
Yeah, but why make us think about it? I mean, you feel sorry for people like that are such not hardhead that they don't understand everybody. We'll have a little quirk, sure. Mm-hmm. We do little things that and this and that that don't quite meet your eye. But your people do the same thing. What the hell? Mm-hmm. You know.
Human beings.
Yeah. So I think you get to learn with everybody, that's all. I mean, that's my feeling is. So.
Yeah. Well, Jimmy, only because of time,
yeah.
I'm going to have to say goodbye.
But oh, yeah. Well,
what a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing so much.
Yeah.
And if somebody wanted to go to the website of the museum.
Yeah, I'm on the Two Lake. I look Two Lake. Mm-hmm. And on the Two Lake.org. Not Two Lake.org, that's on the Two Lake Committee, mm-hmm. but there's a website. I got over about 100 different spots in the website there.
Oh, cool. And yeah. For the website here in San Jose?
JamSJ.org, I think. Yeah.
Awesome.
I think they have, but not that much, but the Two Lake ones. Yeah. You look up my name.
And you'll be there.
I'll be there.
You Jimmy.
Can find me.
Thank you again
much. Yeah, I'm glad to.
And we'll come back and we'll visit more about the museum, and I'd like to walk with you through Japantown.
I tell you, there's a lot of good, funny stories and bad stories, sad stories. What the hell? It's all history, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to get mad at you. I'm not going to get mad at you. You didn't do it. I didn't do it.
Yep.
But, you know,
yep.
It's just people's their philosophy for 13 is a bit different. But like I like regress saying, like in California, we were only 2% of the population, and we they ran 51% of the vegetable business in California. You probably heard that many, many times. So you figure a lot of people, hey, those Japs are taking over the country, you know. But that's everybody has to make a living.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again.
Yeah, thank you. Great. Okay.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We've been speaking with Jimmy Yamaichi at the Japanese American Museum in Japantown, San Jose, California.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Every tree dedication is a living legacy and a gift which grows grander year after year. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show, Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a weekly featured podcast on NPR.org, produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. Our San Francisco-based associate producer is Molly Blaisdell, covering the San Francisco Bay Area, the island of Maui, and the South Pacific. Our Wisconsin-based associate producer is Julie Henning,